I think you should look at learning another language as something natural. Nobody ever said that as a small child you can only handle one language. It is absolutely natural to be able to express yourself in more than one way, and that could be by using another language. And I think it's also necessary to rethink what can we do for our children at a young age, because as everybody says, the door closes.
Hi, I'm Nora Jones. Welcome to It's About Language. This podcast connects language and culture to life, learning, and hope. You'll experience insightful conversations with creative leaders in the fields of education, business, arts, and science. My guests shed light on the impact of language and culture on individuals and society as they share their stories and experiences. You'll be informed and inspired as we explore how language and culture make us human and bring hope in the midst of a challenging world. It's my great pleasure to welcome today to the conversation Inés Lormand. Hi, Inés.
Good morning, Nora. How are you?
I am well, thank you. And I am delighted that we're going to have a chance to have a talk. And one of the things that I just intrigued by, wanted to start with, is the fact that you have such a background of language and culture and traveling and study of linguistics and more traveling, and then publishing and education. And your statement to me was, I've always wanted to change the way the United States approaches language learning, and I feel like I've failed. I'm going to bring both of those up at the same time. Give us some background about why you want to do that and why you think you failed.
Well, let's start from the beginning. As you said, I grew up very multilingual and therefore also multicultural. I was born in the southern part of Germany where I was raised. My parents both spoke French and English on top of German. And my dad was an avid traveler. So on weekends, we liked to cross borders. Sometimes on Sundays, we would go over to France, which was about an hour and a half away, drive down to Germany, drive over to Austria. So it was always normal for me to travel. And with travel also comes language. So that was probably my first exposure. And then because I was born in the French occupied zone of Germany, I actually had to start out with French as my first foreign language when I started school. So I was six years old at that point. And to this day, when I go to France, people often think that I'm a native French speaker, I guess. I never developed an accent. And then when I was 10, I had to take a second language in school, and then eventually added also, other than English, which I took at 10, I added Spanish and later on Latin. But we were able to also pick Russian, for example. And so there was a lot of language learning involved. As you may know, Germany actually depends on export. 60% of the German gross national product come from exporting to other countries. So I think in Germany, it was always normal to speak more than one language because it was part of doing business. Mm-hmm. And so when I was 12, we enrolled through school in a exchange program with kids from England. So by the time I was 14, my parents shipped me off for a summer to spend the time with a English pen pal and her family. And then to that, we added French later on. I went to Switzerland, to the French speaking part of Switzerland, to a boarding school for 1 year.
Interesting.
And when I graduated from school, I decided to study linguistics, specifically Anglistic and Romanistic, as they called it. Then after I was finished with my undergraduate degree, I moved to Spain and I did my master's in Spanish and linguistics at the University of Malaga. When I came back to Germany, I worked for a while as an interpreter, but I found that really boring, other than the fact that it was also very nerve-wracking because there was so much going on and you had to really, really concentrate very hard. And most of the time you were in an enclosed room with these huge earphones that they had at that time kind of plugged in. And so I decided I was going to apply with Lufthansa, the German airline, to become a flight attendant, what they called then stewardess. And lo and behold, very much to my father's dismay, they took me because he thought that was a terrible career choice. And why in the world did he send me to all these places to study? And now I was what he called so fondly a toilet cleaner over the North Atlantic. But it offered me to combine my love for traveling and my curiosity about people and cultures together with my languages. And it also happened to be the place where I met my husband. We met in Cairo, Egypt, at the swimming pool of the Nile Hilton. And my husband, very strangely, because I couldn't believe that Americans were actually able to speak more than one language, he spoke fluent French. He tried to convince me that he was a native French speaker, and I told him there was no way because Americans didn't speak French that well. So where was he really from? And he said he was from Louisiana. He grew up in French-speaking Louisiana, and actually till the time he started school, he spoke very little English. There was one point in our life when we lived in Norway where we tried to call his grandmother and the person. Then we still had operators and she came back and said, sir, you must have given me the wrong number or better, the wrong country code. And my husband said, why? And she said, well, the lady on the other end of the line seems to be speaking French. And my husband said, no, 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 that's true. This is correct. That is my grandmother. She speaks very little English. So, and this now brings me, we're making an arc here. We moved to the United States in 1981. And, I started becoming really interested in what was going on linguistically with French because basically French had died off over the years. The reason for that was that the students were actually forbidden to speak French in class. Mm-hmm. My husband was forbidden to use French in the classroom. And so by the time we moved there, French had died off as a natural language and then was resuscitated kind of artificially by some people in the legislature and some business people that founded an organization called CODAFIL, which was kind of the defense league for French in Louisiana. And they became very aggressive. They brought people from France in. They started establishing exchange programs, et cetera, brought teachers in that would teach French. And that was the time when I was still teaching at the university level. But at that point, I understood, hey, there is a possibility to do something different. So I offered myself to teach French in my daughter's school as a volunteer to kindergartners. And that went really well. I was just absolutely amazed how easily it was to get the kids to pick up the language. It was fabulous. And I knew that kids could learn a language, another language very easily, because our own daughter had actually grew up with three languages. I spoke German to her. My husband spoke English and around the house when she grew up, when she was little, because we still lived in Egypt, they spoke Arabic. So she had, she could converse a little bit in Arabic at the same time, but she lost that when we moved to the United States because neither one of us was fluent in Arabic. So we dropped that. But because my husband and I spoke in French quite a bit, she was exposed to the French and then picked up French very easily. So anyway, I started volunteering there. I went twice a week and we cut out kind of a 30-minute class. And I told them, I said, this would be a great opportunity to start something different here, you know, get the kids to learn at a very early age when they still have the ear, etc. Because by now there was enough supporting evidence that learning language at a young age was much beneficial to the kids. But anyway, this whole thing lasted till a new principal came on who did see absolutely no reason to have French in the classroom, especially for a very, what he called, select group of students, because I could not cover all the different first graders at the time, not second graders that they had. So 2 years later, then I switched over and from the university and taught in a middle school. And there they had just established what they called a, I don't know quite why, but they called it a bilingual program, which meant that within a block of 2 hours, there were 30 minutes of French, and then the rest was English language arts block. Well, when they brought me in, I didn't think that 30 minutes of French was enough exposure. Also, you know, we did that on a daily basis. But so I extended the French to almost an hour. But during French, I was able to teach them language arts, period. Not English language arts, but language arts. They learned about subjects. They learned about predicates. They learned about all kinds of grammar things, which, you know, when you're teaching a language at one point, you're exposing them to grammar. So we did the French language development first, you know, vocabulary building, talking about what interests you, et cetera, kind of laying the basics with vocabulary. But then during the so-called English language arts time, I continued teaching in French, but I taught grammar.
Interesting.
And then after that, we went into English literature. So I had those kids, which was ideal for 3 years. And after those 3 years, they would go on to high school and they would test out of the first 2 years of French, which was really good for the upper level teacher that taught AP, because all of a sudden she had this huge amount of kids coming over and they were all able to place into the upper classes. Before, they had never had many upper courses. So the program became very successful and then they started trying to duplicate it. And after a couple of years, there was really a push from the parents. And that's the most important thing, how the parents get involved. The parents pushed to establish three immersion schools, full immersion schools. So we had to write a curriculum for those schools because there was nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. And starting out with textbooks, we looked at textbooks from France. We looked at textbooks from Canada. And we finally ended up really writing our own materials, writing. I was able to bring the teachers that we had hired in, and we wrote curriculum and we wrote our own lessons, et cetera, et cetera. We had some books that we could use from Canada, but they had to be modified. And but we were able to have three different schools that now offered a complete French immersion program. And I don't want to take all the credit here because there was a town down I-10, Lake Charles, towards the border of Texas that was doing the same thing, and their program was also very successful. So there was enough interest, and again, the interest was on the part of the parents to bring the French in, because they felt that they had lost out by having the French roots, like a lot of Cajun French people have, but never being able to speak the language. So that's where my whole interest kind of came in, and then I just took it and I ran with it. But again, it was important to remember that the kids started out at the very beginning. Now, I see that a lot of schools are now also doing dual language, but I often feel that it is not for the right reason. They're doing it more for political purposes rather than for the, with the understanding that this is a great opportunity to start out teaching kids language at an early age. We have a lot of programs that are in areas where there is a large amount of Spanish speakers, native Spanish speakers. So there it becomes almost natural to offer these kind of programs. But in other areas where you do not, you are not able to draw from such a diverse population, these opportunities are not there. And I really think that that puts them at a disadvantage. I would like to see a lot more equality there, that more programs, either what they used to call dual language or bilingual or immersion, whatever, need to be established here. So that's where the need is, Nora.
But let me ask you some questions based on that history of yourself, of the various aspects of your family, which seem like a quite typical experience in Europe, which is a very large place when you come right down to it, but is considered so much smaller nationality-wise than the United States. There's a sense of connection, of need. You brought up the economic background of Germany, for example. How do people have a sense of urgency here in this country where, as Maya Angelou has written, one can travel from the east to the west 3,000 miles and people are still speaking the same language? Where then does the urgency come from?
That's a very good question. I think that was normally the explanation I got when I asked people why foreign language was only offered in high school mainly, and why, for Pete's sake, was it an elective and not a core subject? And that was always the answer. Well, you know, we don't need it. You can go up across the northern border and they still speak English. And the thing about Spanish, which in the early days, much to my dismay, they would refer to as Mexican, nobody saw a need for it. You know, why would we want to go there? What, why, you know, we don't need them, in other words. But now the world has gotten a lot smaller. And not only do we have a lot of native Spanish speakers in this country now, we also have factories that are supplying us with products that are partially manufactured in Mexico and partially maybe finished here in the United States and vice versa. So there is a lot of exchange going on all the time. And I think definitely the need to study Spanish has been increased, but it is still not offered to everybody. And I think it should be offered to everybody to pick another language in elementary school. And every time I see programs, what they call the FLES and the FLEX programs, come in, they are so all over the map. You know, some of them, luckily for them, have the languages taught maybe two or three times a week. But very often, you know, it's only once a week and sometimes only once in a blue moon. And you also don't have any continuums from the elementary into the middle school and then into the high school. When I ask kids sometimes, so what are you actually doing? You know, have you learned something? What did you take from elementary into middle school? Well, we learned the colors and the numbers and the day of the week, days of the week one more time. And how boring, you know, I wouldn't want to do that. And so I think there not enough thought has been put into how are we going to support the schools. And I'm generalizing now. I do not want to offend anybody. There are wonderful schools out there that are doing a great job. But the majority of the school districts here, they're just, okay, well, so they have had one, the equivalent of 1 year of French. Well, these kids have done French or Spanish now for 5 years, maybe not every day, but they should have passed the stage of numbers, colors, and days of the week. So the expectations are not there either.
Well, and that's an interesting comment right there. The expectations are not there. What has kept educators who are able to see data, brain studies, economic need, security of the United States warnings over the last 30 years, what has kept then educator leaders who have access to this research and this data from changing their expectations?
I think it's probably three main factors. Number one, economics. You know, every time the tax base goes down in a state, the first thing to be cut, other than arts, is the language in elementary. And then the supply of teachers. And I understand that it is hard to get people that are fluent in the language, but also have the background in teaching, you know, because dealing with young students is a little bit different. So you have to have the pedagogy that goes with the language. So that is one reason. And then just the stamina. You know, every time I feel that every time the administration changes, be that on the national level or on the state level or on even on the district level, people with new ideas, with new priorities come in. And then when it comes to, should we buy computers or should we hire some Spanish-speaking teachers? Guess what? So, and that's why I think, sometimes I think if we could combine, and this really, this time right now is giving us an excellent opening. I think what we need to focus on is how can we combine the technology that we now have and bring a language, a speaker of another language into the classroom as a teacher, not necessarily having to be there in flesh and blood, but being able to be there so the kids can interact with somebody, because research supports that kids learn best when they are interacting with an observing or attending adult that does not need to be the specialist in the classroom. When I was working at McGraw-Hill, we had a program, also a crude program as far as the visuals, et cetera, were concerned. It was called Viva el Español, but it was done by Las Vegas Public Schools with a grant, and they had actually done a film production where a Spanish teacher taught the kids in a virtual classroom. So she spoke directly to the students as they were watching her. And it was a series, I think, of 65 different video lessons. But again, there is a lot of money involved there because you need to make it enticing for the students to actually interact, et cetera, et cetera. And the money wasn't there. And there have been some programs developed over the years. One of them, I remember, was from Georgia Public Television. Very nice program. But again, these are done by grants. The grants run for a certain amount of time. Programs are developed, but then there is no follow-up. So a lot of money is spent on the initial start, the start of capital, but then it never goes anywhere, you know, because you have to consistently continue pushing. And that's where the parents come in.
Tell us more about that, because the consistency is a word there that I suppose we could apply nationwide very easily. So how does that connect indeed with parents?
Well, I think if the parents keep putting pressure on the local school boards, the local school boards will be far less inclined to do away with programs that they do not regard as essential. Now, can we change? I mean, ideally, what we would want to do is change this idea of why is learning another language in early childhood not essential? I don't know if that can happen in my lifetime. I would hope that at least a push can be made, but that would be the first thing. But there are enough parents out there now that actually do push for that. But very often it is seen as something only the elite does, and when you have the means, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that is definitely the wrong approach, because I think a lot of students' lives could be enriched and their overall learning improved if they would be exposed to the study of another language at an early age. As a matter of fact, I would see this as a prerequisite to do a lot for the learners that are not as privileged as some kids are.
Since language is a human phenomenon, that makes sense to me, that it would be something that pretty much every student, outside of those that may have significant blockages in their lives, that pretty much every student as a human being would be able to work with language. Some of the things that you mentioned earlier about the way that you integrated the approach to teaching about, say, the structure of language, language arts, not necessarily within the language, specifically of English in this case, but through French. We're looking at the faculty, looking, though you brought in the idea of borrowing people. What are some of the opportunities then, especially in the younger years, for ways that schools might be able to pull all of these needs and understandings of what language is together and make those changes?
Well, I think now that everybody seems to have been working with Zoom, why not identify some master teachers that take on the task of giving daily 30-minute, 40-minute lessons to kids, and the kids just tune in, and there is an adult in the classroom that moderates and maybe even looks at some of the work that the kids are doing. In the younger years, very often they do drawings, but even young children, if well positioned, can do maybe 10, 15 minutes of work, follow-up work, or even the push in kind of prior to the lesson on a computer. And then if you use Zoom and have the whole class instruction on a big screen, then the kids interact with one another also. It just depends on the teacher. The teacher that is on the screen has to use the tools that are at his or her disposal correctly. You know, the teacher can ask, now turn to your neighbor and ask your neighbor such and such, and that will happen. Yeah. So not everybody needs to have a trained world language elementary teacher in the classroom. That's what I'm getting at.
That sounds realistic based on where we are right now in particular. I'd like you to do something right here, Inez. I'd like you to turn to a group of parents that are sitting in a room, and you're about to say to them, the reason why it is so important that children learn language early is because this will happen to your child's life, and this will happen for your community. What are those two things?
Well, number one, economically, you know, you will be able to attract companies from overseas that you may not even have heard the name of. You know, who in the Carolinas had heard about a German company like Bosch? 20 years ago, nobody knew what Bosch was doing. Now they are producing washing machines, dishwashers, et cetera, et cetera, here in the United States, but they also produce parts to cars because down the road, the Germans built BMW, another factory. And so they're feeding into one another. So to attract investments from overseas and have products that we're using here in this country actually built in the United States, speaking another language can be a big advantage. So not only is it an economic advantage for your child, you know, maybe you also need to think about what it does to your child in the sense of overall development. Definitely, there are areas of the brain activated that are normally not activated. You learn to work different hemispheres of your brain simultaneously, where once the student has gone into puberty, that just back and forth will not be that will not continue. At that point, then a third piece has to be inserted. So out of the straight line, all of a sudden becomes a triangle, which it takes longer. And the language is not as purely natural anymore because it has to be channeled through different parts of the brain. So I think that is very important for parents to know that they're giving their children a unique opportunity to create plasticity of the brain that if they wait too long will no longer be there. And so such cannot be used.
That's neat. That's a good exhortation for parents. Okay, let's broaden it out a little bit. You've got a large listening audience. You're outside of the parents' room. You have the microphone for the nation. What are you going to exhort your listeners to do or help them to understand or invite them to do? What's your final word here to those who have been listening to you today?
I think you should look at learning another language as something natural. Nobody ever said that as a small child, you can only handle one language. It is absolutely natural to be able to express yourself in more than one way, and that could be by using another language. And I think it's also necessary to rethink what can we do for our children at a young age, because as everybody says, the door closes pretty much at the age of 12 and then continues closing after that. So it becomes a lot more difficult. But also from a strategic point of view, if we want to compete with countries like China, in the long run, our children need to start studying Chinese. And that really, to become fluent at one point, you need to start at a young age because it's a tonal language. And I can tell you one thing, having traveled in China extensively, There are millions of little Chinese children that will greet you in kindergarten in perfect English. I mean, absolutely amazing. And I do not understand why we cannot do something like this here. I don't know what it is, if it's complacency, but I think it is very urgent these days to understand that we need to do something, not just because of the language, but we also need to be able to understand the culture better, the culture of other countries, and one goes with the other.
Indeed, they do. That's very well said. And we do have an emerging world experience going on. That story that you just told about the young ones in China speaking perfect English, and that's a big country too. That's a very good exhortation for our listeners today. Inez, you've shared a lot of insights by experience, by stories, and by your studies. Thanks so much for sharing today.
Thank you, Nora. It was a pleasure.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and keep up the good fight. We haven't lost yet, okay?
Thank you. I will continue.
Okay. Bye-bye. Very good. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. Let's continue the conversation. Be sure to check out my website, fluencyonline.com, to learn more about our guests and to check out the resources and information they've shared with us there. I have other ideas, resources, and opportunities there for you too. Again, thanks so much for listening, and until next time,